This is the sound of the Barents Sea, about 200 miles north of Siberia. You can hear the gush of waves about 4 feet high, crashing onto the side of an expedition boat. On board that boat was journalist Andrea Pitzer, 4 Russian sailors, and some scientists from Norway. The force of the waves was similar to what the Dutch explorer William Barents and his crew experienced when they ventured to the Arctic in the late 1500s. They were searching for a northeast polar passage to open up trade from Europe to China. Andrea Pitzer traveled to the Arctic 3 times to research her book, which is called Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World. Andrea, that is no pleasure ride. It's hard to not get seasick even just listening to it. Maybe it was pleasurable at the time, I'm not sure, but it was a party compared to what William Barents faced on his first voyage in 1594. Andrea Pitzer, he made 3 voyages in all. What was the purpose?
All the voyages were, in one way or another, to try to find a trade route to China. On the first one, in 1594, he was turned back by ice north of the Russia and coastline. On the second one, they went a little farther south and had to turn back again by ice. The third time he sailed, in 1596, he was one of just a 2-ship tiny fleet that ended up only 1 ship by the time they got there, and they ended up having to stay the winter about 200 miles above the Russian mainland.
So where did he start off from, and how did he get where he was going?
He sailed from Amsterdam north up over Scandinavia and then east across the sea that today bears his name, the Barents Sea, and to a long, thin pair of islands called Nova Zembla, Novaya Zemlya in Russian today. And part of the first expedition was to determine if that might even be attached to a whole polar continent that we didn't know about.
Let's just say you, of course, your trips there revealed much, but you were also using primary source material, such as Barents' own ship log.
Yes, there was actually an account of his 3 voyages that was translated into English more than 400 years ago. And I worked off that and off a Dutch account that I had translated from Old Dutch of someone who was on the first 2 voyages. Using all that, I tried to sort of paint a picture of their whole story.
And tell us as much as you can about his story. On their 3rd expedition, this is the winter of 1596, William Barents and his men became stranded for the winter. How did they become stranded, and what did they do to survive?
Well, the same thing happened on all 3 expeditions. They basically went as far as they could until they were stopped by ice. And like the first 2, they turned for home when they couldn't go further east. But this time, by the time they turned back, they were unable to make it back. And let me say, this was still summer. This was August. This tells you how much ice there was back then. And they sailed a few days trying to get around the ice and then realized finally on September 11th in 1596 that they were stuck for the winter. And they began to carry their goods to the shore, and they began to think about building a cabin. And unfortunately, the first thing that happened was the carpenter died. So they had a big task set before them, but they did manage to build a cabin and fight off polar bears while they were doing it. And it was in that cabin that they ended up spending almost 10 months.
This is how many people in the cabin?
At this point, 16 people.
How did they survive?
They trapped foxes, which had just enough vitamin C in them to keep scurvy from killing them during that winter. They ate their rations. They dug out and had to drag sleds miles to get driftwood for firewood in order to stay alive. They had more than 1 inch of ice on the inside walls of their cabin. It was an unbelievably grueling affair, and they nearly poisoned themselves by burning coal in their closed-up cabin. They ate polar bear liver at one point, and their skin peeled off from head to toe, and 3 of them almost died. So it was really a day-to-day battle to live in this place that was not on any map in existence at the time.
And what was it like to find the site of the cabin? And tell us what was there. And what we're hearing now is the audio that you recorded of the gravel underfoot as you're approaching the site of the cabin. And this, again, is a couple hundred miles above Siberia. What's it like as you're walking?
Well, it's this really long, low, desolate view, this gravelly beach, and then a slight incline up to a little plateau. And that's where they ended up building their cabin. It was exposed to wind on 3 sides and bitter snow that ended up piling up over the roof with polar bears rampaging on the roof trying to get in. But what's left today is just a few of the base logs that formed the very bottom of the cabin. Most everything else has been pulled out through various archaeological digs over the last 130 years or so and is in various museums. But every now and then, people find other little relics. And you can still see the long logs that formed the rectangle for the base. For me, it was really useful to be able to go and stand there and just look out to sea and see the view that would have been just filled with ice at the time, that they would come out day after day and realize how far they were from home.
And along with the encounters with polar bears and the wild there, they saw walruses. And this is something you and the sailors on board the boat saw as well. Tell us about that.
Yes, it was the first time that this particular crew had seen walruses, but they had heard that their tusks were valuable. So they had heard of them. And their first reaction at this place called the Orange Islands was to go overboard into a small boat and try to kill as many as possible to get their tusks. And it was pretty incredible because I had known about this place in the journals. And when we got there on our boat, there were hundreds of walruses on the beach in just the same place. And we didn't have the same reaction, but I was kind of awestruck watching the walruses. And the walruses sat and stared at us for a couple minutes. And then one of the sailors who plays an accordion thought to get his accordion. And he came out and began playing an old Soviet era waltz. And the walruses came and gathered and watched a concert while he played. And I have to say, it was one of the most amazing things that I ever saw.
And there's a fantastic video that you have of it. Let's listen to a bit of it now. The walruses are kind of having a good time. They're sort of enjoying the music.
They really were. They were staring right at us. They were transfixed, and I guess that's how they play, but they were sort of leaping over each other and knocking into each other. And I know that they're actually very dangerous animals. One of, not this crew, but another group, sank a boat the size of ours like 2 weeks later. So I know that they can be actually quite dangerous, but it was clear there in the moment that they were really enjoying the performance.
So William Barents' expeditions resulted in the permanent opening of the high Arctic to Europeans. Could you tell us what that meant for the world?
Whalers ended up in the places, particularly Svalbard, north of Norway, that Barents had discovered. And whaling became a huge industry. And particularly by the middle of the 19th century, you have European nations wiping out nearly whale populations up there. It's this harvest of slaughter that some whale populations have not yet recovered from and may never recover from. And it's also sort of from this era of colonialism where you already had Spain in the Americas and over in the East, but now it's clear many other countries are going to get involved in this search. And the whole world is going to come under this boot heel of colonialism. And that's going to be the Industrial Revolution. And that's going to be climate change. And that's going to be what's affecting the Arctic so much today. And I saw a lot of things already changed just from my three trips up there.
Such as what?
On the first expedition, there was an ice cave we went to that had probably been there for hundreds of years, and there was rain in January, and part of it melted and caved in. We were briefly trapped a little bit. It wasn't anything too serious, but we were all aware that it's not supposed to rain in the Arctic in January. On the second trip, I was astounded by the amount of trash I saw, plastic trash on the shores of the Arctic, just everywhere. And on the third trip, I saw an island that didn't even exist in human knowledge until about 3 years ago, when a glacier retreated so far that it revealed there had been an island off the shores of Nova Zembla this entire time. So it was really concrete ways, not just temperature, but the results of those temperature changes.
So as if you didn't go through enough on your first three trips there, you're going back to the Arctic in August. Why?
I just don't think there's a bigger story that we have to tell than what's happening there and what's happening with climate in the world right now. This time I've been studying Russian. I've been studying cold water diving. I'll go as a sailor on the boat. And my goal in the next few years is to come back with several stories of what happened there in the past, sort of these people that we turned into legends, maybe in some ways that will teach us about why that's not the healthiest thing to do. I'd like to go back not just for history, but also to come back with stories of the very important things that are happening in the Arctic today.
Well, I hope you'll tell them to us. Thank you so much. The book is called Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World by journalist Andrea Pitzer. Andrea, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on, Lisa.